Brother John.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters.
Be heard in stereo. So far as I can tell, and I might well be wrong, this is the first explicit reference I can find to the times which we have just been singing about in that hymn. The times when the Gentiles shall her glory see, and kings declare her fame. Appointed unto her shall be a new and holy name. And as we read these passages in Deuteronomy, one can't but help wonder what on earth they must have meant to the children of Israel. They'd only just come out of Egypt, they weren't even in the Holy Land, and yet here we see Moses giving a prophecy of days which we believe are yet future. Days of a return from captivity which will not occur until after the return of Christ. So whatever it may have meant to them, it seems to me that this verse here, 3 and 4, speak very clearly of the time when the Gentiles will see the glory of Israel, something that we cannot see today. And there's one or two rather important things which struck me as I considered these verses. In the context of Israel being in the desert, they hadn't even reached the land, they hadn't encountered the Ammonites, the Edomites, and the Moabites, they hadn't suffered the dispersion under Syria, they hadn't been taken into captivity in Babylon, even less dispersed by the Romans in AD 70. And yet, Moses says, then the Lord thy God will have compassion on thee, and will gather thee from all nations, whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. If any of thine be driven out unto the utmost parts of heaven, from thence will the Lord thy God gather thee, and from thence will he fetch thee. And you will notice I've underlined there the words, the utmost, or the outmost, which is the same word as the uttermost, parts of the earth. And the Lord has yet to gather them from the ends of the earth. Now what could that possibly mean to Israel? What it signals to us, brothers and sisters, is there is a difference between that which we have been celebrating, if you like, the 50th anniversary of the State of Israel, and that work which has yet to be completed. Jeremiah takes up this theme, doesn't he, in that beautiful run of chapters 30, 31, 32, and so on. And here I have just emphasized and edited, if you like, one or two scriptures. And the reason I've done it, brothers and sisters, is I want to try and make it a biblical study of this subject tonight. To do that, we want to make reference either directly or obliquely to some 40 different scriptures. And the only way we can do it is by putting them on the screen and, as it were, editing out the bits that we really want to draw attention to. But I have produced a list here of all the quotations, together with every single quotation referring to Tarshish. It's a computer printout. And I've given them to Angela Barnes to look after for me. You can have them if you want it after the meeting down here. So there's a whole long list of the references we shall be looking at. But you see again how Jeremiah says, and we must surely be familiar with these words after the special efforts of the last few weeks, for lo, I will save thee from afar, and Jacob shall return. I will make a full end of all nations, not just Babylon. You see, I know that in Deuteronomy 4 there's a reference to the return from Babylon. But here, Jeremiah is saying, I will make an end of all nations whither I have scattered thee. Jeremiah 32, behold, I will gather them out of all countries. Not just back from the lands of the Roman Empire. And I will bring them again unto this place. And Ezekiel takes up the theme and says, for I will gather you out of all countries. Well, brothers and sisters, it was very encouraging, I think, that the ALS should, in that delightful booklet, excellent booklet, God's Living Proof, have seen fit to remind us of an important principle. At a time when we are celebrating, if you like, 50 years of the State of Israel, that booklet reminds us of some words of an earlier brother, Thomas, in fact, that the truth is there are two stages in the restoration of the Jews. The first, before the Battle of Armageddon, which, thank you, Brother John, you've told us about this afternoon, and the second, after it, but both are before the millennium, premillennial. God has said, I will save the tents of Judah first, and this is the first stage of restoration. And so we must bear in mind, and I hope we haven't fallen into the trap of telling our friends that there you are, you see prophecy fulfilled, Israel is back in the land. We must realize that only one third of the Jews are back there anyway. And of those, the vast majority have come from the lands of the previous Roman Empire, or Holy Roman Empire, from Europe, and of course from Russia. Indeed, in the Christadelphian, I think it was last month, they drew attention to the fact that 80% of those Jews going back to the land in the last year have come from Russia. The majority, brothers and sisters, of Jews have still to be returned to the earth, and from whence will they come? Well, Jeremiah reminds us that they are to come, Jeremiah 31, from the uttermost part of the earth. You look at how he puts it in Jeremiah 31. I will gather them from the coasts of the earth. Hear the word of the Lord. Who's he commanding to listen to the work of the Lord? If you look, it says all the nations. He's not talking to Jews. He's saying, now look, you Gentiles, look, you Goyim, look at you nations, listen to what I am telling you about the return of the Jews. Hear the word of the Lord. Declare it where? In Judea or Samaria? No, declare it in the isles afar off. He that scattered Israel will gather him. Isaiah 24:15. Wherefore, glorify the Lord in the isles of the sea. From the uttermost part of the earth we have heard songs of glory. And if you look in your margin, I think, you'll find that where it says uttermost part of the earth, it talks about the winds of the earth. Isaiah 43, very familiar. I'm sure it must have been used in so many public lectures throughout the country in the last month or so. I will bring thee from the east, I will gather thee from the west, I will say to the north, give up, I will say to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons, not just from the other side of the Black Sea in Russia, bring my sons not just on a short-haul jet flight from Europe, but bring my sons from afar, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Now, if we turn to our old friend Jacinius to get his help on what some of these terms mean, we discover that when we read the word isles, we are entitled to take a translation of distant maritime lands. In fact, you'll see that is how certain versions, like the RSV in some places, so translates those words. When we read about coasts, it's a way of referring to the extreme regions of the earth. So when Jeremiah and Isaiah and others say, bring my sons from far, brothers and sisters, we ought to have in mind that map, which I'm sure we have seen many times in the Martin Gilbert Atlas of Israeli history, to remind ourselves of where the Jews are. Chile, Australia, Hong Kong, Ecuador, down there in Argentina. Bring my sons from far, from Mexico, even unto Japan. Lo, says the Lord, I will save thee from afar, and listen, you Gentiles, listen, you nations, because I've got a message for you. I'm going to send out my command, send out my word, to bring my people back from all countries. Now I think we're entitled to wonder, how will it happen? How are you going to bring people back from China and Ecuador and Argentina and Japan and so on? The answer is to be found, at least in part, in Jeremiah chapter 3:19, which is all about the work of Elijah. Now Jeremiah says, but I said, how shall I gather thee among the children and give thee a pleasant land? How shall I give you a goodly heritage in the house of nations? Now I know the NIV puts a slightly different twist on that translation, but it amounts to the same thing in the end, because the answer is, how? It'll be done through the future global ministry of Elijah, using Holy Spirit power to bring his people back from far. And a combination of the ministry of Elijah and, as we'll see later, some Jews, no doubt, and maybe even some saints will go forth. And then and only then will Israel repent and turn to the Lord and call my Father and turn not away from me. So that's how it's going to happen, brothers and sisters. It's going to require the miraculous intervention of a spirit-empowered Elijah and maybe the saints and other Jews to bring about that work. But is there not another answer to that question? How will it happen? Well, there is. We go to Isaiah 49 to try and seek an answer to this question of how will it happen. And again you notice who Isaiah is speaking to. Listen, listen you isles, listen you maritime peoples, listen to you distant coastlands. Listen unto me, and hearken ye my people from far. Behold, I will lift up my hand to the Gentiles, I will send forth my message to the Gentiles, and they, the Gentiles, shall bring thy sons in their arms, and their daughters shall be carried on their shoulders. So a combination, true, of the miraculous spirit work of Elijah, but humanly speaking, using the arms and the shoulders to bring my daughters from far. Isaiah 51 goes a stage further and tells us that the time is coming when the isles shall wait upon me. And upon the isles, these distant maritime Gentile peoples shall trust, wait upon me. And upon mine arm shall they trust. Therefore, the Redeemer of the Lord shall return when the Gentiles trust in the Lord and act, if you like, as God's vehicle for bringing his people back. Isaiah 60 provides an interesting clue. It says, surely those isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from far. So, we begin to build up a picture of a Gentile power, distantly separated, that is going to assist God in the work of returning the Jews to the land. Now, there should be nothing remarkable about that, brothers and sisters. Have we not been reminded this afternoon already of Assyria, and Babylon, and Rome? And they were God's agents for dispersing his people. The Assyrians took them into captivity, into dispersion. Babylon took them into captivity. They came back. And then finally it was Rome in AD 70 that sent the Jews in effect worldwide. Well, having said that, and I don't think anyone's going to disagree, don't let's forget the work of Cyrus. Now, Cyrus was described as a shepherd of the Lord. If you read the first chapter of Ezra, you will see that Cyrus knew exactly what he was doing. He was God's agent for restoring the Jews to Jerusalem. So, was Cyrus a believer? I don't know. What I do know is, if you read Ezra 1 and the first few verses, he knew what he was about. He knew there was a God. He accepted God's commands. But does that mean that he believed in the covenants of promise, that he shared the Abrahamic faith with those Jews whom he was sending back to the land? The point I want to make is this, that we've seen how God works through these kingdoms, through these nations, these powers, at any given time. So in the end, it seems to me that there is to be another human agent, another agency, that will assist in the regathering of the Jews. Now this power we've already read about in those quotations from Isaiah. If we just synthesize and put them together, edit those verses, the latter-day power is afar off. The words it used was of the isles, with many ships, in the uttermost parts of the earth, has powerful arms, a bit of a play on words perhaps, waits on the Lord, trusts in God. Well, you know, did Cyrus trust in God? And then it goes on to say, Isaiah 60, that power is known as Tarshish. So at least we cannot surely disagree, having got this far, that the scriptures tell us that in the last days, and most likely the days, many of them after the return of Christ, there will be a power known as Tarshish that will assist in this work. Now, if I may say so, the really big question, and it is a big question, brothers and sisters, is who is this power known as Tarshish? What does the Bible say about its mission? Well, we've already read part of that, haven't we? What clues does it give to its identity? And how does it fit in and relate to both Judah, whom the Bible describes as being, we could say roughly, the Jews that are in the land now before the return of Christ, and for prophetic purposes, Israel are those who have yet to be saved. How does this power fit those needs before the return of Christ and afterwards? Well, now, unfortunately, we're not given any explicit identification. We're not even given just one chapter that I could turn to in the Bible and say, there you are, that tells you who Tarshish is. Not even one prophet in fact, I think you could probably say there are up to about a dozen or so Old Testament writers who refer to this power in one way or another. Annoyingly, in a way, because it would be so simple if we could say, here it is, it's like Assyria, it's like Babylon, it's like the Medo-Persians, those nations that we've already heard of this afternoon and neatly fit into Daniel's image or Daniel 4 or Daniel 7. But unfortunately, Tarshish is not like that. And I had on my notes, I was going to try and make a comparison. What might it be like? And it's a very tenuous one, and Michael's already pointed attention to it. I was going to say, the nearest analogy I can think of is Daniel's fourth beast. In that, it's a power which definitely existed then. Pick up in Revelation, it exists now, recently, and in the future, but it fulfills a different role. So we have to put together what the scriptures tell us, here a little, there a little, till we find out and can convince ourselves who Tarshish is. Of course, you might want to short-circuit the whole procedure and get the audio cassette catalogues produced by the Christadelphians and get some help from there. Well, I've got news for you, brothers and sisters. There are over 1,000 titles listed in the two main catalogues of Christadelphian audio tape services. And I was able to find only 4 that dealt with Tarshish. They dealt with it, perhaps briefly and indirectly too. So you see, if we're going to make a Bible-based study of Tarshish, and that's the only way to do it, brothers and sisters, we have to work our way through some 27 references. And if you realise, and we really haven't got time to look at it tonight, that Tarshish is very closely related to another subject of Tyre, when you come to look at Tyre, you give yourself another 56 references to look at. What have we got? 80 scriptures that you've conscientiously got to work your way through if you really want to find out in biblical terms who Tarshish is. You cannot do it in half an hour. Frankly, I think you may go home tonight realizing you can't do it in an hour. But I just want to remind you of the story I told at Solihull a couple of years ago. A young brother came up to me and he said, "Brother John, why is it we never hear about Tarshish at our ecclesial meeting?" And I said, "I don't know. I didn't know the ecclesia came from." Well, I did. Because I said, "Look at your ecclesial program. Does it have on the bottom there, no talk shall exceed half an hour, or speakers should constrain their remarks to half an hour?" I said, "Maybe that's the reason, because, brothers and sisters, you cannot make a proper study of Tarshish and all the 80 or so quotations involved in that sort of time." So, what are we going to do tonight? Well, I thought I would take those 27 references to Tarshish and summarise them in the form of what I've called an 18-point biblical identikit. What I have done, and on my copy of that slide, I put down some of the scriptures that apply. Just to follow the list down. The Bible is quite clear. Tarshish is a Japhetic power, Genesis 10. Psalm 72 tells us it's an island power. Psalm 72, the one we have most on Sunday nights. Jonah tells us it's a long way from Jaffa, by boat. Doesn't actually say going west, but come to think of it, you wouldn't get very far going east, would it? Isaiah 2 tells us it's a maritime power. Ezekiel 27 tells us it's a trading nation. 2 Chronicles 9, made up of global seafarers. Ezekiel 27, a unique source of 4 metals. Ezekiel 38, it's part of a family of lions. Isaiah 49 says it's notably pro-Jewish. Isaiah 49 tells us again it is to assist the Jews to return. Isaiah 51 tells us it's a God-respecting, a nation waiting on God. I put in there, in brackets, Protestant. We'll see the meaning of that later. Ezekiel 38 says it's allied to some Arab nations, and Brother John Knowles has already shown us how that will come to pass. Ezekiel 38, it's a Gulf area force. We've just been reminded of that. Ezekiel 38 again, able and willing to challenge Russia at Armageddon. Already been covered. Psalm 48, it is to be humbled. Psalm 60 says, yes, but it is to be restored. Now, brothers and sisters, when you make up a little matrix like that, you then say to yourself, well, if that's what the Bible says about Tarshish, what nations comply with that description? Here are just a few suggestions. Would you say that Russia fitted that description? Would you say that Russia is an island power? No. Is Germany noted for its pro-Israel stance? Italy? Where's Italy's global seafaring power? What about the European Union? Sorry, we've got Japan. Well, Japan is an island power. If you go west, I suppose, through Gibraltar, Panama, and you come round this way. Brothers, I'm not seeking to... I'm sorry if this sounds a little light, but you've got to work these things out for yourself. European Union? Oh, after Robin Cook's visit there? So I thought, well, these obviously don't make sense. So with the help of one or two people, I have collated a series of articles on Tarshish from the days of the Herald of the Kingdom, this is 1851, from magazines in Australia, Canada, America, and Britain. And that is a colossal selection of what Christadelphians think Tarshish is. So let's have a look at some of the ideas, brothers and sisters. There are those who would say, well, really, it's just a Chaldean word for big ships. Well, that's possibly true. Another idea is that it's NATO. Now, the idea that Tarshish was NATO was very popular in the 1950s. But since when does NATO fit this requirement here? Or Syria, meaning southern Syria, because that's where Tyre was near to. It's been suggested that Tunisia is Tarshish. Well, that's not bad, actually, because Phoenicia went to Carthage. But since when is Tunisia in a position to challenge Russia at Armageddon? So when you work it through, well, then it means, as I heard only this week, on Wednesday. Well, really, it's a way of referring to all nations. All nations? Have all nations been sympathetic to Israel? Have all nations got the facility to, well, half the nations of the world, as we've been reminded, are going to be against Israel in the last days. Sardinia is an idea. Actually, I've heard Israel suggested, but brothers and sisters, Genesis 10 tells you that Tarshish is a Japhetic power, and how on earth can it be Israel? One popular idea is, of course, it might be Spain, and the reason for that is, I think, that the Good News Bible and one or two others actually translate with no reason at all Tarshish into Spain, and that's quite a popular idea you'll find in Christian paperbacks expounding those chapters. So what then would be my suggestion? You see, you've got to find a nation that fits, surely, the biblical description of the nation, of its purpose, and its role in Christ, in God's plan. Well, I come to the conclusion that it must be these peoples. Now, what are we to call it? I think you recognize the map of the world there. Some of these colors don't show up quite as well as they should be. But what have we learned? Tarshish, whoever it is, we're told, will bring my sons from far and my daughters from the ends of the earth. The ships of Tarshish first will bring my sons from far. Now, what are we to call this power? You can't call it the British Empire. Unfortunately, some of them still do. Because the term British Empire was dropped officially in 1930. You cannot call it the British Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth Secretariat in London will tell you that name was dropped officially in 1946. So what are we to call it? The Commonwealth? Well, could do, except that we are members of the Commonwealth, are we not? Ephesians, remember? So I wonder, therefore, if we have this kind of difficulty, whether, just for the time being, we could concede that it is a way of identifying the English-speaking people. Now, if you know this, one of the requirements of any nation wanting to join the Commonwealth is that all proceedings will be conducted in English. So Tarshish, then, is something of a moving target. We have a reference in Genesis, right back in the time of Genesis chapter 10, and we have Tarshish still around with the same description applied to it after the return of Christ. It's something of a moving target. In Ezekiel's time, what should we settle for, 700 or 800 BC, it was referred to as a place of the source of metal. In our time, brothers and sisters, Christadelphian times, it'll be part of that great lion family that will oppose the power out of the north, Ezekiel 38, that John Knowles has already referred to. And there are many other roles, as we shall see. And that's why identifying Tarshish is really the first part, first hour of a two-hour study. So all I just want to do is touch on some of those points that we would be looking at in great detail in order to convince you, beyond any reasonable doubt, as to who Tarshish is. One of the interesting points is that we read in Ezekiel 27 that Tarshish, whoever it is the source of four metals, isn't it? Where are the islands afar off that provided the silver, iron, lead and tin to the marketplace of Tyre? Well, the ancient writers were in no doubt, even if some may be today. Herodotus, Diodorus, Strabo, Pliny and others were in no doubt that where the ships of Tarshish went to were to the Tin Islands. Incidentally, are there any metallurgists in the house? Because if so, I would like to know if you could tell me where else on earth you would find those four metals in close proximity to each other. But that's a point in passing. So you see, the Cassiterides, the Greek for the Tin Islands, undoubtedly were Great Britain. Now, I've been brought up to believe that. So last summer, Brother Paul Billington and I, in perhaps an almost sceptical mood, decided to go back to Cornwall to see whether these things be so. We went to the Camborne School of Mines. We spent a time searching through the records of the British Geological Society, the British Institute of Metals, the Royal Cornwall Museum. And anyone, brothers and sisters, who takes the time and the trouble to do it is left in no doubt at all that this land was the source of those metals which were traded in the marketplace of Tyre as per Ezekiel 27. Look, you see what's been going on in the last year. In fact, since we started, or named the subject for today, you've seen that the last tin mine in Cornwall closed. Why? Because there's no tin. There's enough tin there to last another 5,000 years, the geologists say. It's just that market conditions are not right. So, if that part of the identification worries you, then do what we've done. Go down there and make your own study. Well, now, one of the other things that identifies Tarshish, as we have always done as a community for the last 150 years, is to refer to the ships of Tarshish. And here's a rather interesting thing. I came across a book published by Brother Henry Sully. It was in 1915. The Great War had begun, and he was wondering then, the Christadelphians wondered then, whether that was going to be Armageddon. But the subtitle, if you will see, is Britain in Prophecy. And on one of the pages it says, as part of the justification for identifying Britain as Tarshish, is the maritime tonnages of shipping. And you will see from those figures, if you can read them, that the British Empire boasted a total mercantile tonnage of 21 million tons, more than all the other leading nations put together. Well, I'm not the sort of person who believes everything I hear, so I rang up the Lloyd's Register of Shipping 2 weeks ago, and I said, excuse me, but could you give me the updated analysis of mercantile shipping worldwide? Yes, they said. Liberia, Panama, and the Bahamas account for 200 million tons of shipping. I said, oh, very good. What about Britain? 3 million. Ah, you see, there you go. This idea that Tarshish is a shipping power is old hat. It's finished, really. Until, of course, Britain pulled out of Hong Kong. It pulled out of Hong Kong because it had to, true, politically and legally. But Hong Kong isn't what it used to be. It wasn't nearly as important as it used to be. And with the Royal Navy proving itself to be a worldwide force assisted by the American fleet, we have worldwide shipping power even today. If you don't like the Daily Telegraph, then maybe you're an Independent or a Guardian reader, and Britannia is to reclaim the waves with giant aircraft carriers. We're still a major international power. Maybe we've just described it wrongly in the past. I'll give you another example. You know all this bit about lions of Tarshish. It says, doesn't it, Ezekiel 38. The merchants of Tarshish and the young lions thereof. And so, in the early days of Christadelphia, we used to draw attention to the way in which the British Empire would rally round the flag. And one of the characteristic ways of describing that British Empire was with this pair of lions. And there's a recruiting, you must have seen this sort of thing many times over, a recruiting poster for the First World War. But you say, John, hang on, you had abandoned the description British Empire in 1930, so that subject's a bit obsolete, isn't it? Well, I don't know, brothers and sisters. I don't think so. What do you use for postage stamps these days? You've seen these. They're the current issue, aren't they, of 26 pence stamps, which I hope you're saving for the Bible meeting. Do you notice what's upon them? It is the royal crest. It doesn't show up very well in Ascham colour. There is the royal crest, there is the lion, and that royal crest and the lion are guarded, if you read the small print, by a griffin. You have a look at the stamp. But next time you're down in London visiting my friends at Buckingham Palace, call in and see the gate. The very gates, brothers and sisters, of Buckingham Palace have the royal standard surmounted by a lion. And as you take that photograph, atop the gate is the lion. And there is the royal standard, complete with the lion. Do you know those lions have been there since the days of Richard the Lionheart? What's that? 800 years? Edward III, was it, who decorated them with a fleur-de-lis when he got ambitions to go to France? And you know, brothers and sisters, that is the royal standard. Do you remember that rumpus over why didn't the flag fly at half-mast when Diana was killed? Because you cannot lower the royal standard. The king is dead, long live the king. The royal standard, the lions never fly at half-mast. Well, you say that's well and good, but what's that going to do in America? I thought America was the world's greatest power. Well, what do lions do, brothers and sisters, when they grow up? They leave home. And one of the interesting things, well, it's perfectly natural. What does a young lion do? It leaves home. And that's what happened to some of the young lions of Tarshish. Who was the first to leave? America? 1776, the Puritans. You remember why they, the historical background, the Protestants struggle with the Catholics, led to the Americans leaving home, the Puritans leaving home. And what did they do? They took the flag with us. Do you know the first flag of the United States of America was the Union Jack? Look at the way it has proceeded. From the Union Jack, a circle of stars, that's interesting, isn't it? Through to the first Stars and Stripes and the Star Spangled Banner. Brothers and sisters, the first lions to leave home took the flag with them. In 1930, when the title of the British Empire was finally abandoned, by the Statute of Westminster and the Dominions Act, it was agreed that the other dominions, dependencies, colonies, call them what you will, should have a greater degree of independence. And so it came about, consult the facts in your local library, that under that statute, many of the empire's nations operated more independently of each other. Took the flag with them. Do you know that, of course, there was the flag of the United States originally. You know the first flag to fly over the Hawaiian Islands with the Union Jack? The flag still flies over Fiji with the Union Jack. Over Falklands, over the South Atlantic Islands. What did Isaiah talk about? A power at the wingtips. Isaiah calls it shadowing with wingtips, if you like. Remarkable, isn't it? How this power still, well, it's not an empire, not a British Commonwealth. It is a grouping of nations. I thought, well, as we've got John Knowles with us, we'd better put in the Australian flag down here. But I thought also, John, you might be able to answer the question posed by the Daily Mail when the Australians decided to go it alone. This is current affairs, brothers and sisters. This is going on today. And you may say, well, you know, the Commonwealth is just a colonial relic. Well, if it is a colonial relic, then how come so many people want to join it? Yemen, Yemen, Nepal, Burma, who else? Rwanda. The Palestine National Authority apparently have indicated their interest, and so too has the state of Quebec. If they finally break away from Canada, they say, oh yes, we still want to be in this Commonwealth. Brothers and sisters, this is the situation today with nations around the world wanting to join this community. But let's not look at it in political terms. Let us see it much more as a role to be fulfilled in relation to the Jews. And this is the part. What did Isaiah tell us? When you Jews are dispersed abroad, there will be some nations, Gentile nations, who will care for you. And Isaiah 49 tells us those beautiful words, kings shall be thy nursing fathers, queens thy nursing mothers. And so there was a nation that was to become a guardian of the purpose of Israel, in a way. So this nation, that I believe is essentially Britain, came to be Bible-oriented. Now the story of the Reformation is a gripping one. The Reformation, the fight for Protestantism against the Catholic Church, well, John's already referred to it this afternoon. It was a huge story. struggle, brothers and sisters. This was the nation that gave you Wycliffe, Tyndale, Coverdale, the Great Bible. And this afternoon, I guess, there are 350 testimonies in this hall to the King James Version. The struggle of those men against Protestant power to give us the Bible that no other nation in Europe had in anything like the same way. This is the nation that in 1697, an awful long time ago, 300 years ago, said, let's promote Christian knowledge. And in 1804, the British and Foreign Bible Society was created to take the word of a God, to the Gentiles afar off. That was the purpose of it. Now can't we see that what God has said, this is, you Gentiles, what I intend to do with the Jews. I'm going to bring them back, and a Gentile nation will carry them in their arms and be my agents for doing so. That's why this country is Protestant. It isn't anymore. It's Protestant rather than Catholic. If you go to London or you go to Oxford, you will see the monuments, the men who died, brothers and sisters, that you and I might have the Bible and thereby know what saving truth is about. Something that a Catholic country could never have known at that time. We could talk about the glorious revelation of 1688 when William of Orange came to this country, landed at Brixham, came up to London and said, look, I and the Queen are going to make sure that this country never becomes Protestant. And the Queen takes a coronation oath swearing that she will never allow her family to marry a Catholic, how about that, and never allow this throne to be ruled over by a Catholic. William of Orange, Orange Order, Northern Ireland, that struggle is still going on, is it not? And so the Protestant Bible reading environment led many in the 16th, 17th, 18th century to perceive that the Jews would return to the land. This is not a Christadelphian idea. In the 16th, 17th century, there were Jews in Amsterdam who, as we shall see later, were going to Cromwell saying, look, let Britain lead the power or take the power of the Jews back to the Ottoman Empire as it then was. There were people that I could direct you to who saw Britain as their agent. And not only saw Britain as that agent, but saw Britain as Tarshish, long before Brother Thomas ever wrote Elpis Israel. So you see, the power of God, the scriptures, when understood, albeit only in part, led men to see that this country had a role to fulfill. And as Captain Cook sailed around the world and his fellow sailors went in search materially of political power and wealth, what followed? The Bible. Bibles followed flags. Chalmers, Livingston, Carey, Moffat. You know, I want to suggest, perhaps tentatively, and it's not an original suggestion, that the English language became the conduit for the Word of God to spread worldwide. However little those missionaries may have not understood the Abrahamic covenant, the covenants of promise, the hope of Israel, nevertheless, the Word of God, containing his message for the Jews, went worldwide. I might just say that if you're interested in that sort of thing, there is a video down there which will, I think, describe all these things in much greater detail. There's a point I want to make. Many British leaders read the Bible. Or at least they respected it in the way that perhaps you could say, it's not a fair comparison, that Cyrus did. And I have a list there, and we haven't got time to go through them all. But I was just going to tell you about the way Oliver Cromwell, of all people, should have been lobbied to lead the Jews, to let this country take the Jews back to the land. William Pitt was this country's youngest prime minister and made Tony Blair look positively old. He was in power around about 1800. And the story goes that William Pitt saw what was going on with Napoleon. And he was absolutely amazed at the way this little man, this Napoleon, was careering across Europe, crushing the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Northern Italians. And he could not understand how such an insignificant man could so quickly demolish so much of Europe. And it is told how he turned to one of his aides and he said, you know, is there anything in the Bible about this? Well, of course there is, brothers and sisters. You've already turned to that chapter this evening. Revelation 16, brothers and sisters, tells you about the first five vials, all about the things that caused William Pitt to say, Now, is it just possible that this is the work of God? We could go on and talk about Lord Shaftesbury, the great social reformer and politician of this country, how he became president of the Bible Society, founded the Protestant Reform Movement, and he was in the government knowing, and it's quite clear if you read his biographies, knowing what was in store for the Jews. Gladstone, he was a reprobate character, I agree. I mean, these men were not necessarily men of good character, but Gladstone wrote a book, and here it is. You know what it's called? The Impregnable Rock of Scripture. And for a British Prime Minister to stand up in public and publicly publish a book proclaiming his faith in Scripture is something you can't imagine Maggie Thatcher, John Major or Tony Blair doing today, could you? Can't you see what a dramatic change there has been? Lloyd George, it is said, had a Christadelphian nanny. I was told that in this country, and somebody repeated it to me when I was in Toronto last autumn. Anyone heard that one? I don't know. Well, certainly Lloyd George was no great character. But Balfour, now this is interesting. In the Paternal Visitor for April 1950, we read the account of a brother and sister Armstrong of the Haddington Ecclesia in Scotland. They both lived to a good old age. Sister Armstrong had been nurse and tutor to Arthur James Balfour. Arthur James Balfour, whose name we have used frequently in the past few weeks because of the Balfour Declaration, had a Christadelphian nanny. From his earliest days, it seems, he was exposed to the tenets and the teaching of Bible-loving Christadelphians. Is it just possible, when you read of the negotiations that went on in the First World War, that Balfour remembered the sort of things his nanny told him? We could talk about Allenby. We haven't got time. You remember how he got off his horse when he went into Jerusalem? Because he knew there is one coming greater than he. Churchill's driver became a Christadelphian, and if you want a picture of him, they're all there in that booklet. And maybe there are people here from Portsmouth or Smallheath who know the individuals concerned. But brothers and sisters, I'm only saying this because that was the nation which trusted in God, waited upon the Lord, and assisted in the return of the Jews. But look at Tarshish today. Oh, don't let's talk about disgusting behaviour of Bill Clinton, of Robin Cook, William Hague. These are the Palmerstons, the Gladstones, and the Darbys, and the Shaftesburys of our age. Look at them. Peter Manderson, is it? And was it him or was it Sir Terence Conran who said, the millennium got nothing to do with the birth of Christ, got nothing to do with religion. Look at the monarchy being undermined by Rupert Murdoch, who's just been made a papal knight. Did you see it? No, it doesn't make news, does it? He's been made a papal knight for his work in the media. And what does he do? Spend his time undermining the British Constitution. Religious education, virtually non-existent. Did you hear the news on Thursday from the head teachers' conference in Eastbourne where they want to abandon acts of worship in schools? Compare that to the upbringing I had. We look and say that Protestant is almost dead. Catholic infiltration everywhere, and we become suppliant to Catholic Britain. Hague, well, when you look at the state of the Anglican Church divided over the resurrection, see the headline? Church, said Hague. I'd rather go for what? Brothers and sisters, compare that to Gladstone, who wrote about the impregnable rock of Scripture. Are there any teachers in the audience? Been told by the Bromley Central Library that book, which is actually blue, I'm sorry they couldn't give me a coloured copy of it, is now being sent out as a classroom guide to Europe. This is the propaganda that your children are going to be given with the authority of your local education authority. It tells you about what Europe is like. And when I read it, I was quite struck at one thing, because there's a panel in there that talks about the religious life of Europe. And here's something I think quite interesting. It's a breakdown of the religions of each country. So you see Austria, for example. Austria is 84% Catholic, 6% Lutheran, 1% Muslim, 9% others, nonconformists, and so on. And so it gives an analysis of the religions of all the European countries. And you see the great predominance of the Catholic faith. Come to Britain, and what do you read? Protestant? No. Now, what on earth has happened? We are not a Protestant country, brothers and sisters. We're 9% Catholic, 2% Muslim, 34% nonconformist, that's us, I guess, and Jehovah's Witnesses and a few more, and 55% Anglican. Now, when John Knowles is talking about the power of the Roman Catholic Church, don't forget that this publication is the official analysis of a papally inspired Europe, and what does it say about Britain? They're not Protestant anymore. Well, we could have told them that. They're just Anglicans. They're our separated brethren, and before long, they will be with us. If you saw the Catholic Herald this week, there was another six ministers, Anglican ministers, taken in, another 100 ministers taken into the Catholic Church. Time does not permit us to talk about that ridiculous farrago, the Dome of Greenwich, which is near us, which we've seen going up. I wonder what the Pope is going to make of that structure. Madonna and Child?
Well, I don't know. You may say we're speculating, but here's something new, brothers and sisters. Here is the world's first millennium coin. And it's just been announced. Produced by the Isle of Man. Now, the Isle of Man, like the Channel Islands, is not part of... Here is the world's first millennium coin. And it's just been announced. Produced by the Isle of Man. Now, the Isle of Man, like the Channel Islands, is not part of the United Kingdom. It is part of the Queen's dependencies. And it was produced in the Isle of Man, depicting, if you can see it, can you, the mother and child. And it has been formally dedicated to the Holy Father. And what is on the reverse of that coin? The Majesty the Queen. Now, 2 or 3 years ago, if somebody had suggested to you that the Queen would be on one side of a coin and the Madonna and Child on the other, you'd have said, come off it, you're a little bit fanatical, aren't you? You're sort of, going a bit heavy. There it is. And that, within the last month, has been proclaimed as being dedicated to the Holy Father in Rome because of his orientation towards Mariolatry, and it bears on the reverse a queen who has sworn never to let the throne become Catholic. And if any of you are planning special efforts for the year 2000, there it is. That's the officially approved logo by the Greenwich Observatory for 2000. Brothers and sisters, what on earth do you suppose the Lord makes of all this? What does the Lord make of that nation which he clearly has favoured because it did his work of taking the Jews back to land? Woe to the nations that forget God. Now, I can only get on there, I think, 5 quotes, because I know you wouldn't be able to see it otherwise. But what does it say in Genesis 12? I will bless them that bless thee, I will curse him that curseth thee. And you could almost draw the history of Britain in relation to Israel and draw a linear relationship between the two. The Lord said, if you bless my people, I'll bless you. If you curse, betray my people, I'll curse you. Proverbs 14, righteousness exalted a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people. Can you think of any more? Jeremiah 18, would this be a good reaction of the Lord to the way this nation is behaving? If I speak concerning a kingdom to build it, you see, I've edited this quote. If it do evil in my sight, that it obey not my voice, I will repent of the good wherewith I will benefit them. You support me, support my people, and I will bless you. Psalm 50. Now consider this, ye that forget God. This nation have willfully and deliberately forgotten God. Lest I tear you in pieces, and there be none to deliver you. The wicked shall be turned into hell. All nations that forget God. Terrifying, isn't it? The coming judgment, we talk about coming judgment on the world generally, but this is a judgment surely that is going to come upon this nation, which, when it united and became the United Kingdom, were two nations joining together to fight and become a United Kingdom against Rome. You see, what happened in the 1600s, and you've got a King James version of the Bible in front of you, brothers and sisters. King James the First of England was King James the Sixth of Scotland, and when he came to power, just in the early 1800s, by 1806 they'd taken the cross of St. Andrew, the cross of St. George, put them together, and in 1800 they added the Irish cross of St. Patrick.
We haven't got time to delay, other than to point out that this was the time when men were reading the Bible and seeing that there was some Gentile nation that was going to support the Jewish people. And if the Lord has blessed this nation, can we be surprised that the infiltration of Catholic power is such as to start breaking up the United Kingdom? Remember that last summer? If you read, well-informed papers, it's a tragedy of our times that our newspapers are so useless and the tabloids are more preoccupied with the Oscar awards and World Cup football, that you don't see things like this. Scots say yes to devolution. Yes, but who advised them to vote for devolution? Why Hume at Westminster said, look, you bishops, get out there in the field and get the people voting for devolution. It would be the Catholic way to break up the United Kingdom. And that went on in the last year. What's gone on in the last week, brothers and sisters? You know what's made the headlines. I don't care what they say about peace breaking out in Northern Ireland. This is a triumph, yet again. Catholic infiltration. Incidentally, I've never seen the cross used in election purposes, have you? It was used, actually, at the time of the referendum on joining Europe. But do you see, it has become a religious issue, and that is the way it will be. The infiltration of this fourth beast power in its latter-day manifestation is going on, and we don't even realise it. I didn't realise. I mean, I live in Bromley, which is in Kent, no longer Bromley City. I live in the part of Calais region of Europe. I think you better find out which European region you live in, because you can forget the Warwickshire County Council or the West Midlands, what's it, or whatever, wherever it is we are today. Because Europe has decided that Kent and Sussex shall be part of Picardy. And what is happening? There are all plans to rake up the United Kingdom. I have got here a little booklet. The Treaty of Amsterdam. I don't know whether you ever read it. I can't recommend it as holiday reading, but I was in hospital recently, brothers and sisters, and I went through it. And I was terrified at what I read. And I commend it to you. If you want to cast aside the tabloid papers, switch off the BBC, and get down to some serious reading to find out what Britain is about, and you will, I think, be appalled when cabinet ministers stand up and say they haven't even read it. So when you read it, and you see what is coming to this country from Europe, you will be appalled. We ask the question, well, what can we do about it? Now, there's a thing called the European Journal. Incidentally, if you want this kind of reading matter, do see Donald Pierce afterwards, because he's got a lot of stuff that will inform you well on this subject. Can Britannia waive the rules? No. If you read what thinking people are saying in the debate in the House of Lords recently, you will see phrases like constitutional crises are inevitable. Well, of course they are. We're the only nation, I think, in the world where the head of the church is also head of the state. And who's head of the church? And who's going to be head of the European state? Well, John's already told you. Chaos and anarchy must ensue. Irreconcilable incompatibility. Now you may think, well, this is all a bit, little bit above me. This is the broadsheet weekend editions giving the heavy stuff. Well, if you are a fan of the tabloid press, brothers and sisters, you can't possibly have missed that. Look what William Hague said 2 weeks ago. We're talking about the signs of our times in 1988, nay, in May 1988. Sorry about that. It's age catching up with me. You see, that's why you take wives, to correct you in flight. No, seriously. If you read the report of those Yale and Harvard financial professors, you will know they have said the same thing. There is trouble in store for Tarshish. Now you may say, well, that's all right, John, but I mean, I don't know who it was. Was it Brother Roberts or Brother Thomas who said, well, that's just civil wars in the synagogue of Satan, I think was the phrase they used. What's that got to do with us? We've been called out of that. All right? You keep up to date, then, sisters? Do you realise how the European Convention on Human Rights
Did you see how it was debated in the House of Lords only, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago? And how it went back through the House of Commons, and not one newspaper I got out of the 7 or 8 I bought carried any report of it at all. How the threat to church freedom is coming from Brussels. John's already referred to what they're doing in Germany, and I could tell you a story, because I was concerned about this. You see, the church is sitting back for litigation. Give an example. I don't know if this hall is licensed for weddings. If it is, by whom is it licensed? Coventry City Council. State. Oh. Have you got the right to prevent a Muslim being married here? Have you got the right to prevent a couple of Mormons? I mean, how can you possibly discriminate against people like that? You can't, under European law.
So I was a bit perplexed with this, because our hall is. How long will it be that some of these provisions are going to impinge on us? Conscription, sisters included. Those who employ staff in religious hospices will be vulnerable. And so that debate went on.
I decided to ring the someone I knew at the Salvation Army, whose headquarters are just by our hall in Forest Hill, not far away. And I spoke to one of the generals there, I think he was, or lieutenant colonel, and I said to him, tell me, how are you getting on with all this European human rights stuff? And he said, could I ask him, is there any truth in the rumour that the Salvation Army has had to appoint an atheist
to run the Salvation Army in Holland? And he said, no, but we have had to reorganise our church organisation completely. I said, what about marriages? He said, well, we too were very worried. But he said they had been in touch with the Lord Chancellor, who had decided that no one in this country has a right to be married anyway. Interesting, isn't it? So the Salvation Army are breathing a sigh of relief at something that the Church of England can't do, because they are an established church. I told my wife, it's a bit late in the day to tell us we had no right to get married. Brother and sister, these things are serious. How long will it be before, and I was going to spend much more time on this, until this week, and I scrapped this last part of the talk, because there is confusion and contradiction in Westminster. Britain, as we shall see in a moment, has no part of this part of this power of Europe. Doesn't really show what I wanted to show, which is the sun setting over Westminster, losing our autonomy in favour of Brussels. Back to the Bible, Ezekiel 38. Here is a map which you've already seen this afternoon. It comes from a different source, and it shows our conventional understanding, if you like, of Ezekiel 38. Here is the power out of the north, Meshech, Rosh, Tagarma, Tubal, Mago, Gomer. I think, John, you'd agree, this is. Sometimes there are discussions on the details, but broadly that's right. Well, look at it. If you are persuaded that Britain is Tarshish, how on earth can Tarshish have anything to do with Europe, when you look at the confederacy and the nature of it that is coming down onto Israel? Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Trouble ahead, brothers and sisters, for us at Tarshish. Isaiah 2. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, everyone, but it then singles out Tarshish, and upon all the ships of Tarshish. Psalm 48. For lo, the kings were assembled, they passed by together, they saw it, and so they marvelled. They were troubled, and they hasted away. Fear took hold of them. Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish. Now, why this special reference to Tarshish? When you say that judgment's going to come upon all nations, yes, and including Tarshish too. Why? Because that was the power that the Lord entrusted care for his people. And so judgment's going to come upon Tarshish, and we wonder why. And how? Might this be a result, brothers and sisters, of the storm resulting from the earthquake on the Mount of Olives, a great big tidal wave sweeping away the American Sixth Fleet out of the Mediterranean? Might be. Could it be the intervention of the saints? Now, this is quite a popular idea, isn't it? That this is just a figurative way of referring to the intervention of the saints at the time of Armageddon? What about an attack on Tarshish from its next-door neighbour? Those of us who live in Kent are only 22 miles through that Euro tunnel from Gomer, Mago, and so on. I'm old enough to remember Dunkirk, when the Lord stepped in and through the little ships saved this country. And now, Tarshish is going to be assailed in one form or another, and we cannot escape it. Is it a way of talking about the humbling of cool Britannia and Clinton, the comeback kid. Consider what did Israel. It betrayed Israel. So the Assyrian power came down out of the north. It's interesting then when we see what Robin Cook did when he went to Europe, when he went to Israel. He went there, his whole visit was a disaster, and excuse me, diplomatic disaster. Now, all I want, I haven't got time to look at that in any more detail. What did he do? He went as a European Union representative. He put the words of the European powers and their attitude to Israel and completely upset Israel. Could you imagine Balfour doing that? Could you imagine Palmerston, Gladstone, and the rest of them doing that? No. Look what a turnabout. Here he is singing the tune of the harlot. Isaiah 23, reference to Tyre. He's singing like a harlot, like Isaiah 23 says of the power of Tyre. Turned its back on Europe. So what's going to happen? There's trouble in store for Tarshish brothers and sisters, because there is still a future role for Tarshish to be fulfilled. Psalm 72, the most read chapter on a Sunday night. We all go through it. And also, this talks about the return of Christ to this earth, and we never deal with verse 10. And yet, what does it tell us about the future for this country? He shall have dominion from sea to sea. The kings of Tarshish and the isles shall bring presents. Now, this is the same Tarshish power. And yet, how is it going to come back into favour? Isaiah 60, arise, shine, thy light is come. The forces, and the margin puts that in the wealth, the goodies, the wealth of the Gentiles will come unto thee, because the message went forth to the Gentiles. Hear, O ye nations, hear, ye isles, I want you to do a work for me. And yet future is surely those isles will wait for me. The ships of Tarshish first will bring thy sons from far. And if we put those quotations down together, brothers and sisters, we are left with one conclusion. And that is, somehow, and we know not how, Tarshish must undergo some very humbling change. Judgment is coming upon this earth. Something has to happen. We don't know how, we don't know when. But if you think, well, that's a bit fantastic in this world, can I really believe it? Did you really believe? John's already referred to it. Time was when we used to have leaflets about communist Russia never getting together with Catholic Europe. If you believe that, you believe in Alice in Wonderland, remember? Did you ever believe that Russia would become the, quote, Orthodox Christian country it has become now, carrying out Christian persecution rather than communist persecution? What about the Berlin Wall, the United Europe? Did you ever really think the wall would come down and within a few years we would have a united Europe? Well, you might have done if you were old-fashioned enough to read the old Christadelphian words. But come on now, be fair. Most of us didn't expect that to happen, did we? Did you expect to see Rabin and Yasser Arafat shaking hands on the White House lawn? And what do you think of a person who in 1848, when the Ottoman Empire dominated Israel, could stand up and say, I believe in the partial return of the Jews to the land before the return of Christ? Speaking personally, do I believe in 1948, when I was baptized, when the state of Israel was created, that I'd ever be standing here talking about 50 years of the state of Israel? How will it happen, Moses? I don't know. Perhaps some natural disaster. Perhaps some cataclysmic event in the world of politics, society, monarchy, the leadership of those powers of Tarshish. I don't know. Something has got to happen. And I've often thought a lot in the last few months, and we'll be reminded of it sooner as that. Remember it? Here was something that brought the nation to a standstill. Shockwaves reverberated around the world. Businesses closed. Entertainment stopped. Sporting events were cancelled. Shops were shut. 12 Christadelphian magazines, be they from Australia, Canada, America, and Britain, all commented on this event. It was a shock to society. And we wonder why. The nation was reduced to grief, it was reduced to meaning. In mock concern for a religious Christian funeral. And I still ask myself, was there something there, a message? I don't necessarily agree with the Daily Mail, but The crown, it said, will be stronger after his tragic death.
Why did it happen, brothers and sisters? Was it to punish the monarchy for their wayward ways? Or was it, as many brothers and sisters will believe, it was to save the monarchy from the way it was going? Was it to condemn the lifestyle of Tarshish? Or was it to show us, in small part, how a nation could be reduced and humbled and brought to its knees, to prepare Tarshish for what is in store? I don't know, brothers and sisters.
But what I do know is this. Something's got to happen. Tarshish has got to face judgment for its betrayal of Israel and for its betrayal of the trust that God has given. Because the kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents, ships of Tarshish shall bring thy sons from far, and the wealth of the Gentiles shall come to thee. That's the promise. That is going to happen. This is where we are today. What will happen in between time, I don't know. But we can say quite definitely that trouble is in store for Tarshish. Chapter 11, in that day he shall set up an ensign for the nations and shall shall assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth, Isaiah 11. For then shall the earth be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Future. And there's that most enigmatic and difficult, I've only seen one translation of it, interpretation of it, that difficult verse in Isaiah chapter 66, verse 19-20. Forgive me attempting my own translation or presentation of it. But Isaiah 66 tells us that I will set a sign, that is Jesus, among them, the Jews, and I will send some of those Jews, with Elijah, to Tarshish. And they, that is the Jews, and yes, the same, will declare my glory among the Gentiles, and they, Tarshish, shall bring your brethren, that is the balance of Israel, back to Jerusalem. Brothers and sisters, something's got to happen to facilitate that change of heart of this power of Tarshish. We know not what it is, how it will happen, or when it will happen. But this we do know, that as Moses assured the people of Israel in the desert, the time is coming that the Lord will gather thee from all nations, from the uttermost part of the heavens. And that's where we started just over an hour and a quarter ago. I'm sorry I've gone on so long, brothers and sisters. But Moses was looking to the time when all Israel, long dispersed, mourning, seek the Lord their God. Then shall Israel be saved. War and tumult then shall cease, while the greatest son of David rules a conquered world in peace.